Everyone, welcome to the LSE Policy in Practice seminar series. Good to see so many old familiar faces, names, but also new ones that I've known on paper. Looking forward to engaging more with you this year. So effective policy making requires careful analytics and empirics, but it also requires navigating politics and the world of implementation. And while one can learn analytical skill sets in the classroom, engaging and learning about the real world requires going beyond the classroom to the world of practice. And proficiency and analytics and empirics and practice is what we at SPP want our students to be equipped with. This we are hoping to do in many ways. I do it in my courses. I know a number of other courses also do it. This seminar series is also an attempt to bring the world of practice into the world of academia. And today we are fortunate in having one of the foremost persons at the cutting edge of both research and academia. Let me call him a guru. Someone who is at the cutting edge of both these fields, someone who was very well trained at MIT PhD, very well published, but then chose to go into the world of practice, both at the bank, but then within the bank also leaving the comfort of the big office in the DC, going to the field, going to Indonesia first, and then to a number of other places. I hope Lant can tell us about that choice and what he subsequently learned from that choice. But one thing I can already say from my personal experience that we are all, not just Lant, we're all very thankful for the choices that he made and all the more wiser for those choices. I'm personally very grateful to Lant for having learned from him, and I've seen him in operation in different parts of the world, all kinds of places like South Sudan, Juba, India, and many other parts of the world also. I've seen him in operation at Harvard. I've seen him how passionate he is about teaching and how he wants to instill these values and this perspective in his students. And that's why he's held in very high regard by both his students and everyone else who has engaged with him. So I think I could go on and on, but rather than embarrassing Lant any further, let me stop here. I think Lant is one of those, like truly one of those persons that who doesn't need an introduction. Let me stop here and hand over to Lant, but let me tell my students, while you listen to Lant, I would request you to both critically reflect, but also to intellectually to engage with him. Lant also loves not pushback for the sake of pushback, but intellectual arguments. So he would very much want you to intellectually engage with him. So without further ado, over to you, Lant. And thanks very much for accepting to deliver this talk. Thanks.
So thanks for having me. It's a little ironic that I'm actually in London, and yet we're still doing this virtually, even though it's the London School of Economics. Glad to talk about this particular issue of the interface of sort of analytics, evidence, kind of policy approaches and implementation, as I have gone back and forth enough that people who know both think I'm the other. It amuses my truly operational friends no end that academics think I'm operational. They just laugh and laugh when I got hired as a professor of practice. So what I'd like to start with, and I'm going to really just talk for maybe less than 20 minutes, because I really do think you're probably sick of hearing people that are talking heads on your screen and not giving enough time for questions. So I'll leave plenty of time for questions, and I have answers that will shock you. So I will give you honest answers, which are unusual in this world. So let me just start by telling a little bit of a narrative. I was an MIT PhD, had published articles and books. And when I was 40 years old, I thought I was pretty smart. I thought I was, if not, you know, the cat's meow, at least the cat's purr, but I was a pretty capable person at understanding issues and coming up with policy proposals and solutions. And at 40 years old, I then moved to Indonesia at a particularly critical juncture in Indonesia. I moved there in August of 1998. If any of you know anything about Indonesian history, Suharto had ruled the country essentially from 1966 to 1998. He had resigned in the spring, I think it was March or May of 98. And so Indonesia was in the middle of several overlapping, very severe crises, economic, natural, political. And I went with the bank kind of to become an operational person, no research responsibilities, nothing analytic, and just to assume a task of getting things done. And I would say for at least the first 6 months, I just got my ass kicked. I just lost every potential critical struggle with anything practical. I just was getting outsmart, outfoxed, outmaneuvered at every stage. And I said, and rather than, and many, I think, academics and some of my colleagues who've tried to get into the operational end, rather than coming to the conclusion that the world is a cynical place and these other people are evil and I'm good and I just can't make a difference because everybody else is too evil, I decided that there was a skill set that I was missing, that I really needed to learn how to be a more effective at getting things done and getting governments to adopt and implement things that I and people around me thought were good ideas. And I realized there were three big things that as an academic writing about policy, I had never really fully wrapped my head around, and that I needed to wrap my head around those things in a much more effective way if I wanted to be an effective person. So the first of those is the world in the operational end of it, and maybe some of you have worked enough, is policies actually are super, super granular. Meaning they're full of really enormous amount of detail, and a policy has to be complete. Whereas nearly everything you've heard about policy in an academic environment, neither is truly at the level of granularity that it actually makes it practical. It's more at the level of, you know, things like safety nets should be targeted to the poorest. Great. Tell me in specific detail, how are you going to assign, you know, if you really want to target, to what level are you going to target? You're going to target households? Every household, therefore, needs to be assigned an eligibility status. You can't assign half the households an eligibility status on some statistical criteria. And the process of assigning every household an eligibility status has to be complete, and it has to be, and it's going to be granular. So if you're going to say, oh, yeah, I have a targeting index, I mean, I'm using examples that were real life examples from Indonesia because I ended up in charge of an unbelievably scaled, given what a naif I was, loan operation to support safety nets to mitigate the consequences of the crisis. You say, okay, we'll target on an asset index. Okay, great. what's the weight of every single asset? How are you going to measure every single asset for every single household? And basically, everything that anybody recommended was just naive about the scope it would take to implement it with the granularity and the completeness that it needed to be implemented. So that's words that would describe policies and would describe in some sense the design space within which a policy would happen, or at least would describe three of the seven dimensions of the policy to space. But I just really had no idea how the specificity with which one needed to immediately engage, and that it had to be complete. So we had, for instance, and what I mean by complete is we had data provinces of Indonesia. We had good data on, reasonably good data on what the magnitude of the crisis had been across provinces. Unfortunately, there were, and I don't remember the exact number, but there were 26 provinces and we only had data for 22 of them. Well, you know, the governors of the four provinces weren't very happy about being excluded from getting anything, any benefit from the safety net because they didn't happen to have data. On the other hand, the other governors weren't very super happy at these other governors coming in and claiming they had these poverty impacts. Well, they had to be limited to their claims by the data. Okay. Second thing I learned is that everything I thought about politics was focused on the idea of there being a government and the government having policies. I very quickly learned that a huge amount of the what was going to determine which policies were going to be successfully adopted and implemented were actually internecine struggles among the organizations within the government. The idea of the government was completely useless. When we were saying, well, let's implement a safety net program or a set of programs, it was immediately which of the organizations wanted to have safety net programs and were willing to even modify some amount of what they did, which of them, you know, and which of them were just not interested. So we literally had, in an unbelievably tight budget situation because of GDP had fallen 15% in the previous year, so massive budget cuts everywhere. We were the only game in town. We had hundreds of millions of dollars of budget that we could give to individual government agencies or organizations if they would implement a safety net program. And yet the most ex post, what was the most effective set of programs were a set of work for wage programs that created employment opportunities. And we dangled literally hundreds of millions of dollars in front of the infrastructure agency to design and implement, you know, kind of a workfare scheme. They just wouldn't do it. They just would not do it. And basically I came to realize it was just incompatible with their vision of who they were. You know, a lot of organizations, they have a one sentence description of who they are. And their description was, we build stuff. And, you know, hiring a bunch of people with shovels to do small scale public works, whatever its interest and the national interest was, whatever the government wanted, the agency just didn't want it. They were just like, no, we build stuff. And like, you want to, you know, clean out a bunch of drains, that's somebody else's business. You want to build a bunch of like berms to do flood control, somebody else's business. They wanted to build big highways or big structures. And like I say, you would think they would be interested because we had the only money and lots of money. So I learned that organizations are not fungible. Organizations have internal histories and dynamics and narratives of who they are. And you know, whatever the government says is going to happen, if it can't make, if you don't have the organization itself, and the organization itself is a complex creature, on board, you know, government policy can be whatever government policy wants to be, and the prime minister can announce whatever they want. But in the end, you got to find a way to find an organization or organizations that are aligned enough with your objectives that they'll take it on enthusiastically, or else, you know, you can design the program, you can fund the program, you can put it in the budget, but in the end, you can't think. So I realized that almost any word that involved the government was insufficiently granular and informative to be predictive of what was and was not going to happen. The third thing I learned, and this is, I'm only going to say three because I learned lots of other things. The third thing I learned is that, and I've since come up with ways of expressing and representing this, but I learned that, you know, you have to be super flexible and completely inflexible at the same time, in the sense that there are ways to design your program such that variations in how you do it aren't going to make much difference to the outcome. And so when you're designing a program from a technical optimizing sense of, okay, how would we spend this money best so that it reached the most people? We could design what we thought was the technically optimal program, but sometimes the technically optimal program just raises just enormous, has enormous political costs that another design that seems that produces almost the same effect doesn't have those political costs. And so being flexible to say, if I change the design in this following way to make it more politically acceptable, will it limit, you know, and I'm using my hands, you know, there's a response surface over the design space, and that if I design it this way, will it produce the impacts I expect or will it not? And oftentimes there's kind of flat ranges where your outcome is going to be actually pretty robust to this design feature, but somebody else cares a lot about this design feature. And by the way, vice versa. there are ways of taking your program and moving it in dimensions that seem minor and completely undermine it. So one example, and this, I thank heavens, wasn't anywhere near this. But the banks were failing. And so they had to design some emergency program for the central bank to provide liquidity support to the banks. Great. Then granularity and completeness comes in. And so when the technocrats drafted this kind of, so what they did is they're going to put a guarantee on the bank's lending, right? In order to encourage the banks to lend and stuff. And when the technocrats designed it, they of course limited the liquidity support the central bank was going to provide to any given bank to the net assets of the bank pre-crisis. Like, okay, literally in the middle of the night, and Indonesia was a reasonably corrupt country. It wasn't the most corrupt country in the world, but it wasn't by any stretch the least. Literally in the middle of the night, some people got to the legislation before it was passed and announced, or the executive order before it was passed, and just deleted three words. But the three words were the words that limited the liquidity support of the central bank to any given bank. So what did they do? The banks that were on the inside and had deleted those three words, the minute this liquidity support was announced, they just made billions of dollars of bets against the rupiah by putting tons of money abroad and betting against the exchange rate with you know, the backing of the central bank to provide them little liquidity to make this bet and a loan guarantee against it. So they just printed money in just unbelievable amounts, in a way that, again, so three words, they changed three words. And when my technocrat friends woke up in the morning, they realized that the entire intent of the liquidity support, or not the entire intent, but they realized that they'd just been had and that the central bank was literally going to give away hundreds of millions of dollars to three banks owned by influential politicians. So there are, you know, about that three words, you had to be there, you had to be inflexible, completely, totally inflexible. It was like, no, we're not changing those three words. Whereas there are other parts of the design of it that you could have been flexible about. So what I learned is that a lot of the policymaking process is deciding, where can I give that matters to other people that won't matter to me? And where can I absolutely not give? And that is, so when people talk about the evidence, they're just anybody, I mean, I don't know. I think most people that use the words the evidence as a single phrase are full of shit. They don't know what they're talking about. Because you just don't have, you know, you have to make decisions about where am I going to be flexible and where am I going to be inflexible, that the granularity of what evidence there is just never reaches to that level. You have to make judgments about how robust is my outcome going to be with respect to these minor changes, which matter a lot to people, versus if I change this one little feature of the design program to make somebody happy, it's actually going to undermine its entire effect, or it's going to, you know, end up. And so all the time you see academic types come in, write a wonderful policy that, you know, ends up to be drafted into implementable legal language 150 pages long, and then four words in paragraph 2 sub clause C undermine completely the rest of what they were doing because they didn't. And, you know, they had to have been completely inflexible about that and watch it to the very end. Whereas other things, you think somebody comes and wants to change your optimal design, your design's actually pretty robust in that dimension, and you can give a lot to, and make people happy by moving in a direction that your output is, your outcome is robust with respect to, but which pleases other people. So I think a lot of this is just unbelievably fine, nuanced judgments about how you come to an acceptable compromise by and like every compromise, it's an arbitrage. You want to give people things that are valuable to them and not that valuable to you, and hold on things that are valuable to you that aren't necessarily valuable to them. And sometimes it's just a conflict that it's valuable to both of you. But knowing that just goes so far beyond where any technical evidence of the rigorous type would take you, that you realize being effective in operations is a lot about knowing exactly where to be maximally flexible and keep your adequate support. Because if you're not adequately flexible, you can never assemble the coalition you need to get it into practice. But at the same time, you know, not let the final details gut what you're doing, which, again, it's often two sentences or four words along some critical design dimension that'll completely undermine what you're doing. So those are three things I learned that are related. One is that relative to any discourse that you would read, actual policymaking is unbelievably granular and needs to be totally complete. If you're going to have a policy, it has to cover every relevant case. And, you know, you can't assume away that four provinces don't have the data. Second is that the government is a mythic creature. Inside the government, there's dozens of power bases and organizations, and ultimately successful implementation depends on organizational dynamics. And if you don't have the organizations on your side, nothing you can do, and nothing, by the way, nothing the president of the country can do often. Partly they're president because they often know which things they can do and which things they can't do. And finally, you know, you really need to be simultaneously massively flexible and massively inflexible. And part of the art of being engaged is knowing when you actually have substantial latitude to give, because it won't make that much difference, and when you absolutely cannot give, or it'll completely undermine it. And then be willing to be flexible enough to assemble a coalition that's powerful enough that you can resist moving in the directions that you need to resist that would undermine it. So those are three things I learned. I would say after a year and a half of doing this, I was pretty sophomoric at it, but at least could get some things done and wasn't getting my ass kicked every time. But it did take respect for the process and respect for the people you're working with. Because if you go in thinking, oh, I'm this super smart person and I've been trained here or there and I know what's right, yeah, you might as well go home. You're not gonna be effective. You're not getting anything done. You're gonna end up bitter and cynical about what other people have done, but you can either do that or you can actually acknowledge this is a separate skill set. I need to learn it. I need to be good at it. And once I'm good at it, then I can maybe get some things done. So those are the only things I wanted to say, just as a kickoff. And then I'm happy to entertain questions and give honest answers to most of them.
Thank you very much, Lance. This was perfect. This was great. So I'll invite questions from the audience, but let me abuse my position to start off with the first one by myself. I think what you said makes perfect sense in terms of technocratic design not being enough, in terms of evidence as typically understood, a typical notion, a simple notion of evidence, both in the singular, but also evidence of particular types, rigorous or whatever, like being deeply problematic. I think those are points very well taken, but are not necessarily well established in the world out there. So partly the question is, why is that so? Is it incentives or politics? But my other question is about the three insights that you mentioned. So the granularity of policy design, which is not just one technocratic design that you have either design some social planner or someone out there, someone sitting in Java or like some like Jakarta or some like central ministry designs, which is how typically usually governments are like policy. And if I'm blunt, like also donors also usually, this is how policy is usually being suggested and implemented. But granularity of design is not easy to comprehend and to design. And besides the mantra of like you learn from experience, so what advice would you give to our policy students in terms of how to build the skill sets and how to be ready for this? And similarly for the other thing that you mentioned, like government not being a simple like a black box out there. Yes, absolutely. I've served long in government to realize that government is not just one beast out there. Like there are many, many, many different governments. And one thing that never failed to amuse me was anytime you had a discussion with government, with someone in government, they would say someone else has to decide. And despite all of this talk about government being accountable, I had never in my life seen someone, either individuals, but more importantly, agencies being held accountable for their performance. Never. Yes, there are political crises and other things. So in terms of government, again, like perfectly understood, but especially the first and the third comment that you made, granularity of policy design, and the third one was about the being both flexible and inflexible, which is again, very similar to that point, but which also requires, call it like immense skill sets, both analytical, but also a sense of the politics in the room, the interest of different players. And how does one learn that? How does one get a sense of this? And both in the sense of like our students, the policy students, but also like not just at the individual level, at organizational level, why is, how do you promote more of this? How is this not being practiced more often? Why does one has to do it ever and ever again? Like, in other words, like Matisse and this analytical knowledge that you're talking about and the different dimensions. So in some ways it seems very like overpowering, or like that you have to think of the granularity in so many dimensions, but then also think of the call it the cost and the function also in so many dimensions. So is there a way out? Is there a practical suggestion that you would give?
So I think, let me try and handle two of things I heard you raise. One is that I think we pay as policymakers, often we want to promulgate like a, when I say things have to be complete, they either have to be complete in dictating outcomes, or they have to be complete in dictating a process whereby the decision about the outcome will be taken. And I think the technocratic impulse of most people who've been trained as academics is to centralize and write a policy that specifies exactly the outcome in each instance. Whereas I think part of the flexibility you want to build is, at what level and in what ways can I allow people to make decisions and use discretion that deals with the granularity of the particulars, that again meets the objectives of the program, while at the same time doesn't, you know, go to an excessive level of granularity. So let me tell you one of my favorite stories from Indonesia and the safety nets. Is one of the things that happened is, given the inflation that had happened, the price of rice had doubled in a country that had had low inflation for 30 years. Having, you know, the price of your staple food double in 3 months was just unbelievably traumatic, or believably traumatic. I'm waving my hands, on top of which other things that made it even more politically hot, because much of the rice trade in the private sector was in the control of ethnic Chinese, and so you can imagine how that played out politically when the prices doubled. So it was super important to stabilize, in some sense, people's access to rice. So we created a safety net program that said every targeted household had access to buy 10 kilograms of rice at this fixed price. And that wasn't, you know, the entire household's consumption of rice, but it to some extent, by fixing it in a nominal price, it made the subsidy variable so that you were assured that no matter what happened to the price of rice, you had this much rice at this price. Decent program. Okay. Then how do you target it? Well, there was this list of households that the Ministry of Family Planning had created that said who were the least well-off households in five categorizations. So they said, we'll use this list to decide which households are eligible for to buy the subsidized rice. So immediately, you know, and that met the criteria of being granular and complete. You know, you were eligible if you were on this list, you weren't eligible if you were on the list nationwide. Okay. No way in a million years that was ever going to happen. Because this list was sort of, had never been high stakes before. So who was on it and who wasn't on it, what had never really been adjudicated or really fought out. All of a sudden, you were getting a huge benefit if you're on this list, not on this list. And so basically, what happened was nearly every village head decided on some other procedure for allocating the rice. You know, they said, okay, the targeted households get the rice every month and all the non-targeted households get it every other month. Or in some villages, just everybody gets, we're just gonna take the rice that they give us Because after all, what would happen is the logistics agency would show up and give you the amount of rice that corresponded to the number of eligible people times 10 kilograms. Then the village head was responsible for really. So again, there's many, many dimensions to this story. So I'm, you know, I'm the World Bank. I'm supposed to make sure the money is going to the targeted household. So I do what we call supervision. I fly to one state. I say, here's the list of people getting the rice that you provided. Are you sure the rice is really going to only in all these people? Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, it's only those people getting it. Like, okay. And I randomly, and I'm smart enough, I'm like 6 months in, let's randomly choose a district and go to that district, right? Because of course, if you tell them you're gonna, you know, arrange for me a district to visit, they'll choose some district, they'll have rehearsed the answers. So randomly choose a district, we go to that district. Again, at the district, they have the list, all and only these people, absolutely. Now we show up in a village, randomly chosen, you know, five white SUVs. And, you know, they get there and like, okay, where's the village head? And like, they track the village head down and this guy kind of drives up in his motor scooter. And I'm sure he sees like five SUVs in his village and thinks, oh shit, like, what have I done to deserve? Why are they dropping in on me? Nothing good can come of, you know, nothing good can come of a surprise visit from state officials, right? So, so we get there. I asked the village head, here's the list. And of course, each place this is Indonesia. They were masters at documentation. You know, here's the list of the people in your village that were supposed to get rice. Is it really only these people getting rice? And he says, oh yeah, of course. He knew the right answer. And then like literally this is how much investigation it took. I said, really? Because in lots of other villages I visited, the head of the village is giving it to other households who are just as much in need as these households, because that's the fair way to do it. And the village head says, oh yeah, of course. I don't give it to only those households. They'd tear me bit to bit. Like everybody in this village is suffering from the crisis. They all need some support. So what I've done, and then he described what he was doing, which was, you know, being flexible in the allocation of the rice in ways that, you know, prevented it from getting torn apart, but which he felt roughly was, you know, satisfying the intent of the program. He wasn't like stealing it all. He was diverting it from the targeted households. Okay, we can have some other discussion. Then I turned to the people who had come with me all the way, you know, the 2-hour trip from capital to district to block to village. And I said, look, all you guys, you all knew that this is what was happening. Why have you been telling me for the last 2 hours that the rice is only going to these targeted households? And the guy from the state, he looked at me and he said, well, you're from the World Bank. You've never wanted to know the truth before. Good point. Now, what is all this about? What all this is about is the technocratic impulse is to create rules for how things are going to happen that are never actually going to be implemented on the ground. And then as long as you provide the paperwork that looks like that's what's happening, you're happy, right? We're gonna give you the rice. You give us the list of eligible households. We've got rice into the village, which was the important objective. Like, and you know, these people from the World Bank wanna be sure that it's targeted. Let's tell them it's going to the right households. And that's often the equilibrium that exists in which de facto is being operated. Now, interestingly enough, we set in motion as part of this thing, a whole bunch of these was a later RCT of targeting that compared and contrasted kind of technocratic targeting to village targeting, where they just let the village have a meeting and decide who should get what. And it turns out the village targeting worked just as well in a technocratic sense and made everybody happier because they felt like they had some discretion. Right? So this time around, when the government of Indonesia was faced with implementing a massive safety net program in the midst of a crisis, COVID, they decided to not specify exactly who was going to get the benefit. They decided to specify kind of a process whereby the amount of benefit going down to various jurisdictions happened, and then used, you know, village consensus meetings with publicly publicized lists of who was eligible and who was not eligible. Didn't even try to create a technocratic decision. So this is kind of your answer to the question of granularity, which is part of the issue of getting good at granularity is deciding everything needs to be granular, but does need to be granular in terms of outcome or in terms of process, right? And how much, when do you say, here is the process whereby we are going to let some other official make decisions using information that they have at your disposal that isn't really available to make the top-down decision, that satisfies the mix of granularity and yet, you know, it's granular, but it's granular with respect to process, and not with, and then allows the granularity to actually play out at the local level. So that was a very long story, but I think it's a super key story because, again, what a policy specifies is decision-making rights and authorities, right? And the technocratic impulse is to always centralize and make things only depend on super objective criteria, which can then be, you know, collected into reports that get fed up. But often the reality is discretion is going to be exercised and you should design the granularity to control the exercise of discretion in appropriate ways that can produce about the same result as you're completely technocratic and yet actually be much more effective in controlling the discretion. Because you don't allow for the discretion, it's going to happen, but it's going to be beyond your control because the actual facts, the facts that you're dealing with are a complete fiction. You know, the facts that were being provided as to who was getting the rice, complete and total fiction. But once the government has accepted the fiction as fact, you're actually in a very, very bad position. I'm hoping this is making sense to students. I'm hoping.
I very much hope so. So I'm also glad that the Indonesian government learned from its experience. So now over to students. So like, let me bring them in the order in which they raise their hands. Bethany, why don't you come in and over to you.
Yes, Dr. Pritchett, thank you so much for speaking with us. I'm a first year MPA student. My question is, you've talked about experiences that challenged your expectations for how to implement policy in practice, but I'm curious if you also have stories or experiences that you can point to that challenged your fundamental beliefs or theories about how development works, or kind of your general philosophy for even approaching the underlying problems. Do you have maybe an experience you could share with us where you got challenged in that way?
I have one, but it's probably not what you mean. And so we'll come back to what you mean. One thing that it took me a very long time to get over, and this is related, is I, for a long, long time, thought that the development process was creating and establishing rules and then ensuring the fair and kind of non-discriminatory implementation of those rules. And that kind of what the development game was about was having better rather than worse rules, which is kind of the policy, often the approach to policy, you know. And I started my career as a trade economist and hence dealt a lot in the beginning of my career with trade restrictions. And now I'm much more cognizant that mostly the world consists of a set of deals, that rules in most places in the world have very thin traction on the actual behavior of actors. And hence, I'm much more interested in structuring what Michael Wilcock, one of a co-author of mine, calls good struggles, that if you can be part of creating a mediating process whereby good struggles happen about what the deals that are going to be made are and how they emerge, that in the end is going to be a lot more productive for the development process than creating good deals, the good rules. And so I think most of the good policy proposals that are made by people from the North or the West or whatever we call it that aren't actually deeply integrated in the countries they're working with in the development process, I think I've come to believe they mostly do more harm than good, because they short circuit the struggle. They often create rules that are attractive and in some sense optimal and desirable in one context, but are kind of transplanted from their context, create a tension where the rule can't really be implemented. And so it distorts the deal space. So I think a lot of what I used to think of would have been good reforms are actually counterproductive, like passing, you know, really attractive business legislation and stuff. It's like, it can easily create more harm than good. So, is that kind of what you meant, or did you want something?
Yes, no, I think that answered my question. If I could just ask a quick follow-up, can you give maybe an example of what a good struggle would look like?
What?
What a good struggle would look like? Like what's
yeah,
that?
Let me give you an example of what I mean, right? Which is, I was working, because I had a student who was from South Sudan, I ended up working on South Sudan kind of in the run-up to its independence. And so, and one of the things, one of the things that, you know, one of South Sudan's fundamental challenges was, how do they have any economic activity? What can they sell to the world to generate exports besides oil, right? One thing, by having been a conflict country for a long time, one thing they had is a lot of unexploited timber. You know, they had forests that weren't necessarily environmentally valuable and had a lot of valuable timber in them and had never been harvested just because there was conflict. And so they had these forests, right? Then there were kind of debates about, well, okay, you know, who is going to be, under what conditions are people going to be allowed to harvest these forests? And what the international organizations were promoting was that they write a forestry law. And the forestry law should have protection of the environment, it should have protection of indigenous people's rights, it should have, you know, all kinds of green certification that you weren't cutting down too many trees. And all the things that would sound good to you and probably are elements of a forestry law in a developed country like Germany or the United States, right? And my change of heart, I probably would have fallen for that 25 or 30 years ago, because it would have seemed like the way to have a good forestry is to have a good forestry law, right? I begged them not to do this. I said, no, look, just form a commission that is adequately reflective of the social forces and political forces in Tanzania that would have credibility to give out franchises for certain parts of the forest and make deals, and go to the 5 or 6 most highly reputable forestry companies in the world and say to them, what would it take for you to come and harvest trees in South Sudan? What are the conditions under which we could write a deal whereby you're going to come and harvest trees in this area of South Sudan? And then do 10 of those with this commission that explicitly is going to be able to have flexibility about what are the terms and conditions under which a forestry firm shows up, right? So that's what I mean by a deal. It's explicitly, we're going to enable a struggle over what a good deal looks like, right? And we're going to have, you know, we're going to have some civil society organizations represented in this process, maybe bring in the Archbishop or whatever and have some representation. So it's not going to be a closed deal. It's going to be a relatively open process, but let's struggle our way towards what we mean by what are the terms and conditions under we as South Sudanese will feel comfortable with people harvesting our forest resources, okay? Now you can guess what happened. What happened was, and this is an example of what I mean by why good laws are terrible. I'm now mostly, my slogan nowadays is good laws are bad laws. because what did they do? Under pressure from the donors and what the hell, they didn't really care. They passed a forestry law that had all these wonderful conditions in it, which everybody knew was not going to be enforced. Like this government had no writ. It had no capability. It had nothing. Like there were like 15 South Sudanese who had an advanced degree in the whole country, right? How they were going to enforce this law. Okay. So what's going to happen? Who is going to come and harvest timber in an environment in which the only legitimate, only possible way to harvest timber is to cut a deal and not comply with a law? The worst forestry people in the world. And some of the people in forestry are really evil, awful people. And who's going to come to South Sudan are the awful people. Well, once the awful people are there harvesting the trees, they love this good law because it keeps all the good actors out, right? They love the backdoor deal because there's no transparency about the deals they're cutting, because once everybody recognizes the deal can't possibly be incompatible with the law, you can no longer do it in the open. We can't cut an open deal because the law precludes a feasible deal. And so you ended up with a beautiful law and the worst possible people harvesting trees in the worst possible way in South Sudan. Is that even clearer about what I mean? And so I think I was a sucker for good laws. Because good laws, like if you live in a country that has the capability to enforce good laws are good. And a lot of what advocacy in the political sphere consists of lobbying for better laws. Whereas if you superimpose, you know, these wonderfully designed laws onto terms and conditions of countries that just have no capability for enforcement, you actually create a really negative dynamic, because then the actors who are willing to come into those spaces of those term conditions are the worst actors, but since they dominate the space, no pressure for a new law, because the people who are, you know, arbitraging on willingness to violate the law, they don't want the law changed. Am I even clearer, Bethany?
Yes, no, that's very interesting point.
Yeah, and I think a lot of you know, it's easy to be seduced by policy advocacy for good laws, right? Oh, what I would do is I would go and give them advice on what, you know, best practice laws in forestry look like. Well, that may be anti-developmental. That may have short-circuited the good struggle that could have actually resulted in a feasible, good enough, but on a positive dynamic way in which Sudanese were going to decide who were going to cut their trees down. By the way, I grew up in Boise, Idaho, and if any of you have heard of Boise, it's because it's on a package of paper, because it's what we sell to the world is trees. So some of you might object to the example that trees are cut down at all, but for me, cutting down trees is what people do, so in a responsible way. Okay.
Okay.
Now I'm starting to see what I mean by I'll give you honest answers. Like, when was the last time you heard good laws or bad laws?
That's a great, I think, tagline for today. Okay. So the next one is Shanti, Margaret. Please introduce yourself.
Okay. Hi, Dr. Pritchett. I'm Shanti. I'm an MPA second year student, and I'm from Indonesia, who also happened to work for the central bank. So I can attest to all of your stories. And personally, I could say that situations hasn't changed much after 20 years. So yeah, so that was also part of my worry, because I have to go back, and then I have to go back to my institutions, and then I have to practice policy, which, as you have explained, that sometimes, especially when it comes to deal with the parliament, it seems like to hit the wall, like evidence making, policy making is considered nonsense. And most of the time that acceptance to such thing is not in the equation. So my questions is a bit personal. What kind of advice that you can give for a young policymaker like me who have to work and go back and work in such environment and to stay motivated in policy making, to know that you're doing a good work and not to be in this autopilot mode. Thank you.
So let me say several things. First is if you leave, somebody else is going to come do it. So I know that, and you are going to live your life full of moral ambiguity. When am I crossing the line of, I think I'm on average doing good for the world by staying engaged in the public policy process in the Central Bank of Indonesia. At the same time, I know that the Central Bank of Indonesia and or the parliamentarians and or other people are doing things that are illegal and wrong, right? The first thing is that withdrawing from the public process into something else because you're close to things that the government is doing that are wrong, I don't think helps anybody, because somebody else is going to do it. And if you're committed to public service to do good, almost certainly the person that would come and fill your place is going to be less committed to public service than you are. And so, you know, you don't solve any problems in the world by withdrawing from the process because it is rough and dirty and, you know, things. Second, and this is a little harder, and I've had lots of I probably shouldn't have promised, to be honest. You know, I have lots of friends that have been in various governments and been in various government positions, and the ones that I respect and have managed to be successful and effective aren't in the room where the cash changes hands, but know that it's happening and don't make any attempt to stop it every time. You know, politics in nearly every country in the world, and particularly in countries that are, let's say, weakly institutionalized, is going to involve a lot of things that are just blatantly illegal. Now, the difficulty is, and this was the lesson, I think, of the Suharto era, and I'm going to use an example from Indonesia. Is that once you're in the room where the money changes hands, you lose kind of all the leverage you had, because anytime you object to something or take a stance, someone can come back and go, yeah, well, look, you were in on this deal, you were there in the room. Like, so managed to maintain the distance, which is, you remember Marzuki?
Marzuki Ismail, yes.
You remember him from the early transition? How old are you?
Yes.
How old were you in 1998?
I was 9 years old.
So one of the stories from the transition with Suharto that's very instructive, and you should think of it all in your personal life, is one of the people that had been in the Suharto government, but who was regarded by the outsiders as being the most, as the cleanest of them and the most committed to human rights, actually in the early transition government became the Attorney General. And as the Attorney General, he announced that he was going to get very tough with corruption. A week after he announced that as Attorney General, he's going to get very tough with corruption, the parliamentary committee announced they were forming an anti-corruption drive and that the first person they were going to investigate for his engagement in corruption was the new Attorney General. Because in order to have been as high a level in the Suharto government as he was, he had obviously been involved with things that probably were illegal, and hence they had the goods on him. And hence, when, even though the political situation had changed, when he went to leverage and become a reformer, all they had to do was the whole anti-corruption drive just stopped, because everybody realized that anybody powerful enough to actually be in the current government had been part of the process. And hence, so as a personal advice, you're going to have to live in and around things that you're uncomfortable with, but, stay out of being directly involved in being in the room where the bags of cash actually change hands, enough that you maintain your credibility as a technocrat. I just don't have to be there. There's no reason for me to be there. And yet, you can't fight it. You might know that it's happening. You might know it's having a role in the policy influence. Okay. Third thing is, you have to develop outside options and outside ways of bringing to bear support on your internal positions, or else you ultimately can't be effective. So you need to play an inside-outside game to where the insiders see you as loyal enough to the organization that they keep you at the table. But at the same time, you're seen as linked to powerful and influential sources that provide a check on what the organization can get away with. And that, it's a very difficult role to play. I'll bet anybody who's been in the senior civil service of Pakistan can attest to how they play that game of being inside the civil service enough that they're seen as a loyal kind of civil servant and they're not out necessarily rabble-rousing. But at the same time, the most effective of the senior civil servants have power bases and influential power bases just outside enough of the organization that they're respected for their inside-outside contact. Is this resonating with you at all?
Yes, I think that also answered my question. Thank you.
I'm super acknowledging that it's a super tough decision, right? Now, I think, by the way, having been 40 years old in 1998, Indonesia is night and day a better place than it was in 1998. I mean, it may seem like not that much has changed in Indonesia. And in many ways, I go back to Indonesia at least once a year and have for 20 years. And maybe by being a little bit of an outsider, I see more of the change. I'm not saying, it went... I think there was an illusion that it was going to go from dictatorship to democracy, and that those large kind of descriptive adjectives would change the daily world. And I think everybody is disillusioned with that. That said, in terms of the scope with which technocrats have to make decisions, with the scope of individual local politicians and local government workers, to me, it's night and day. I mean, when I tried to have, would go visit district offices in Indonesia in 1998, 99, no one felt they had any scope to take any action. And now you go to localities and it's rough and tumble, but they feel like they have autonomy and they're taking action and they have ideas and they have strategies and they have, and I think the struggle has shifted in enormous ways that are I think largely positive. Large parts of the what's happened politically or a reconstitution of the new order for sure. But at the same time, I think it's been enormous progress. And you know, you kind of have to day to day, year to year, have to make the decision. Do I stay in it enough that I can have the influence I can have from the inside, or do I try and affect it from the outside?
Thank you. That was clear enough.
Very well said, Lant. I remember from my experience in government, the few opportunities where we had some internal battles were the ones where we built an outsider coalition with people from the outside, people mm-hmm. who were not allies, who were critical, very critical of us, but whose support was needed sometimes through selective leaks, sometimes through other means to fight internal battles. But it was also a very knife edge. If you do too much of that, you lose internal credibility and the other way around also. So very well said. Now the next, let's go to Paulo and then Emery, and with a request to Paulo not to steal the thunder of Emery by asking the exact same question that he wanted to ask, which was what I think Shanti did to him up here.
Thank you very much, Lan, for the presentation. And I'm very glad you're being very honest. It's very refreshing for us. So I'm Paulo Barbieri, I'm from Argentina. I'm an MPP student and a Chimneen scholar. And I spent a few years working in Washington at the Inter-American Development Bank. And then for the last 2 years at the UN here in South America, more on a field role, also always related to operations. So my question is gonna be, do you feel like there's some tension between your urgencies and the daily politics at the field level and the innovation or solutions and that are being championed at headquarters level and how to deal with them? In the sense that there's within the organizations, I'm guessing the World Bank is pretty much the same, there's some principal agent problem in the sense that decisions taken in DC might not reflect the reality of the field. And on the other side, maybe some innovation could have been mainstream to really push the boundaries of the implementation side. So how can you get that real middle ground that it's very tough because, for example, I've seen blockchain projects, total failure because they were not adapted to the reality of the country, but also policies implemented at the field level that could have been a little bit more updated and modern and innovative, and how to achieve that middle equilibrium.
So I think one thing that the international organizations, and I actually think the IDB is a good intermediate, is a good example, is they kind of help set kind of what's on the agenda, right? And in that, they can be powerful. And then the question is, as you move down from the agenda and the themes to the granularity and specifics, right? It's trying from the center to dictate from the theme and agenda all the way to implementation inevitably gets the local details wrong, right? So a colleague of mine, Susan Watkins, who's a sociologist, wrote this really interesting book called The Romance of AIDS, right? And she wrote it about, you know, during the AIDS crisis, there was these global organizations that here's the strategy for tackling AIDS, and they had created a national AIDS control organization in each country. And to some extent, there was way too little actual scope for local variation in the AIDS control strategy. And so as she pointed out, the agents kind of in the field were caught between these top-down dictated policies that were just wildly irrelevant to the actual on-the-ground realities, right? And so that was an example of the global, in some sense, trying to penetrate too deeply, too granular. On the other hand, you know, you want So I think maintaining this tension right, and I think there is a huge scope for a community of practice that has national actors, cosmopolitan actors, and global actors in creating and evaluating and reflecting on the agenda and the themes being taken up, but they need to reflect critically on creating a supportive environment, therefore, for more local actors to adopt and implement things consistent with those themes without trying to dictate it. Does that make sense? So it's sort of like, and by the way, a good example is, I think a good example, and I'm sure half of you will think I'm revealing myself as a neoliberal kook, but you know, a good example is in the era before, back when your parents were thinking of having you, you know, chronic inflation was a really big problem in the world. You know, lots of countries in the 1980s had, you know, lots of countries in the world had chronic high inflation, and it was a serious impediment to lots of things. And people came up with the idea of independent central banks and inflation targeting as kind of themes of how the central bank process could insulate itself and resist the fiscal pressures to monetize deficits in order to reduce chronic inflation. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is inflation targeting actually turned into having completely different implementations. So lots of countries that all existed in this global discourse about inflation targeting were actually doing wildly different policy practices in order to implement inflation targeting. So even if you adopted inflation targeting, it wasn't a narrow set of rules of the way the central bank would behave. It was agreement to certain goals of the central bank and then an approach to meeting those goals called inflation targeting. So I think they got it more right that they weren't actually trying to dictate to each central bank some, you know, script of how they act, but they created a global atmosphere that created legitimacy around the idea of adopting inflation targeting that then, and I'm using this as like, here's the global and cosmopolitan actors and interacting with national actors, right? Let me give you another example that I'm involved in right now is over the last 10 years, I've been working a lot on education and I've been part of a group that's created the learning crisis. So now lots and lots of international organizations and people that talk about education refer to the learning crisis. Well, when they refer to the learning crisis, we invented it. It wasn't actually on the global agenda. Learning outcomes were not a strong part of the global education agenda. And in order to create the conditions on which national actors could act with respect to improving learning, you actually had to free up the space at the global level that it became an agenda and a thing of something that was important to create a community of practice that was discussing how would we get to better learning outcomes. So we're not out there trying to dictate, you know, this is the appropriate technique to improve learning in every country in the world. We have no idea what that might be, and it's going to have to be adapted. I mean, good heavens, you know, education is a process of millions of daily interactions between teachers and students. But until you shifted the global agenda and made it clear that priority to these tasks and themes rather than those tasks and themes was a way in which resources and ideas and research could flow, it wasn't necessarily supporting on the ground implementation of learning improvements. So again, I'm just trying to give you examples of the way in which the global and the cosmopolitan regional can interact with the national and local in ways that are productive and unproductive. So I'm a big believer in creating global movements, global communities of practice, global things, as long as, again, they don't get into, you know, because every time the global actors try and specify the specifics, they screw it up. They screw it up in all kinds of ways. One way they screw it up is what we were talking with Bethany about. I'm pointing to where she is on my screen. you know, that they then want to pass these gold-plated things that are irrelevant or impossible in country circumstances. Other way they screw it up is they try and be too narrow about the exact programmatics, and then you have these programs that are in some sense living in two worlds and conflicted between, am I really going to be relevant to the realities of Malawi, or am I going to, you know, please the AIDS control organization taskmasters in Geneva by telling them what they want to hear? So was that responsive?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Over to you, Amri.
Okay, thank you so much. Nice to meet you, Lant. Well, I think this is a personal opportunity to ask you really personal questions. Most of the time we get a lot of spaces to make questions that are technical, and I guess this is a great opportunity to make personal questions. Like, this is pretty much building from Shanti's question is, well, imagine, well, I'm from Guatemala. I'm an MPA from the second year. And well, Guatemala is, as you know, not a best place to be a policymaker. Like, your life is in danger and many of these things. But the truth is, I want to go back and do something about it. So, and one of the things you mentioned is like, you learn all these things from the best universities and then you arrive to the reality. And pretty much you notice like the skills you acquire in the first world or in the developed world were not as useful in on the ground. So my question pretty much goes around that. It's like, okay, then imagine I'm a younger version of you. Please help me realize, what are the things I should be learning then? What are the skills I should be developing? And where should I be doing things in order to gain those skills? Because obviously, yeah, it's a great experience to be here, but from what you say, it's like, okay, you're gonna learn it somewhere else. Thank you.
Let me start this with what is in some ways a bad example, right? Because the student of mine that I was working with South Sudan was named Peter Ajak Biar. Peter Ajak Biar just got out of prison, where he was in prison in South Sudan for 2 years for having been saying things that were actually quite mild, but critical of the government, and the government arrested him, put him in prison and tortured him. And interestingly, I just had a conversation with Peter. In some sense, he was put in prison by the South Sudanese government because he was so well connected internationally. His Harvard degree, and the fact that, by the way, both his father-in-law and his father were well connected in the South Sudanese government, and his, you know, he was in the middle of a PhD from Cambridge University in the UK. And so he was one of the more internationally visible South Sudanese young leaders. And so the South Sudanese leader, and I had this conversation with Peter, he and I both believe the South Sudanese leadership said, if we can put Peter in prison, every South Sudanese youth will know we'll put them in prison too. So we'll go after the most promising leader, the most internationally well-connected, the most globally visible South Sudanese, because it'll be a signal that if we'll mess with him, you know, if we'll put him in prison and have the US ambassador and the British ambassador and the State Department and everybody calling and pestering us, if we're willing to do that, every other South Sudanese is going to realize, I'll just disappear. I'll end up in the river, right? So, first of all, so, you know, playing your international experience and skills and into local politics is actually really tricky, right? And local politics is a full contact sport. It is not, there's no rules, right? Okay, so first thing is I think if I'm trying, I want to find a space in which I can be powerful and they don't really care yet. And you know, like I say, if you're attacking a powerful kingdom and they've got some huge centralized fort with, you don't attack the fort first. You kind of take some area they don't really care about and create some success there. So let me give you an you know, the name we call this in our progress in our work on is problem definition. Create a problem that you can work on that doesn't directly attack the power basis of the government. Because if you directly, you know, a frontal attack will almost certainly end up with you in exile at best, right? So you want to think of where is this space in which I feel strongly I can make some practically challenge key interests, demonstrating the possibility of success in Guatemala, right? And so I think that, you know, an example of this is I had some colleagues who were working in South Africa. South Africa has, at the time and probably still, has just horrific crime rates, horrific rates of sexual violence. And at the time, women who reported sexual violence to the police were just unbelievably badly treated, including risk of them, police carrying out sexual violence of them when they went to the police station to report sexual violence, right? So you could say, I'm gonna fight police corruption. I'm gonna, you know, take on corruption in the government. Instead, they said, we're just gonna work on that a woman is decently treated by the criminal justice system when she reports sexual violence. And it was sort of like, and create a coalition around solving that problem. It wasn't necessarily the biggest problem in South Africa. It wasn't the entire problem of South Africa. But on the other hand, it was a, once you kind of isolated a problem, you could create a coalition that could work on it without immediately generating the resistance to stomp on it. And they created incremental and in the, you know, in the medium term, actually really substantial progress on that dimension, right? And you might say, oh, that's only one dimension or that's something, but it was something. And moreover, the networks they created in solving this one problem, therefore created a network of like-minded individuals who A, saw they could in fact have impact, B, saw ways of working even inside a corrupted and otherwise structurally violent system that could make progress. So that's, pick a problem. So part of this is pick a problem that kind of is important enough, but, you know, this is what I was saying earlier about, you know, how much can you be effective without taking, you know, massive risks and taking on head on in a way that at the same time is a thin wedge, is a thin wedge into the problem, right? And the thing about the thin wedge theory is you want to find something that's a thin wedge that's thick at the back. You're creating a wedge where I can get something done now, but I can see that behind what I'm doing now, I've got a wedge to start cracking open the system, right? And so, you know, the alternative to the thin wedge thing are sliver, you're doing a tiny thing and it's gotten a wedge behind it, or sledgehammer. But, you know, the odds that you're gonna be successful with sledgehammer, you better make sure you have all your ducks in a row before you go for sledgehammer. So a thin end of thick wedge is, I think, a strategy that I've seen lots of people be successful with. It takes a long-term vision, it takes careful planning. And then the second thing about it is you want to, the main way in which all of you can be successful is creating an environment in which other people can be successful. Meaning, one of the problems is that since attention to policy problems in social sphere and around lots of issues is so scarce, you actually end up with this lobster problem where everybody working on the problem wants their solution to be adopted and hence ends up criticizing other people working in the field on different ways of solving the same problem, right? And therefore, instead of actually creating an effectively networked group that's leveraging each other's efforts, you're all in the business of going after donor support and philanthropic support and other support and tearing each other down. Whereas if you can be the part of creating the network that enables successful action of others, while at the same time, you being a successful actor, you A, in the long run, are gonna have more impact, way more impact, because you change the playing field. If you say, so for instance, you know, I work with this organization in India that both had a way of teaching children, but also had a low cost effective way of assessing children's learning. And one of the things that they got right is they kept their assessment arm completely separate from their action arm so that they could be seen as, we are promoting learning for Indian children by assessing and showing how awful it is and what a priority problem is. And anybody who wants to work on and solve this problem, we're rewarding and encouraging that work by creating an environment in which all of that is seen as important, right? And not have it seen as, our assessment instrument is being used to demonstrate the success of our practical instrument, so you should give more money and support to our specific solution. So they actually created an umbrella of people who could have very different ideas about what the solution to the problem was, but could agree on publicizing and prioritizing the problem. So building effective networks is super, super important, because in the end, leadership is the empowerment of other people. Leadership is almost never successful at, Uberman, I'm gonna impose my will on the universe. So those are the two things I would say.
Very well said, Lant. I hope we all agree it was an excellent session. I know there are many other people who wanted to come in, including some like Bethany, who wanted to come in again. But unfortunately, we have run the clock and we have run out of time. Fortunately for everyone, Lant will be with us, hopefully for a decent duration. I hope as long as possible.
We're working on that. I plan to be around again next term.
Sure. So you'll get hopefully other opportunities to engage with him, and hopefully in an in-person sense also. So please, everyone, join me in thanking Lant. He was excellent. Thank you very much, Lant.
Thanks for having me. I might not have been right, but I hope at least I was honest.
It was honest and blunt, honest, but also very insightful. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye, thank you.